suing court case.
Yes, exactly. I have been following that case, and I know that some fairs and some FFA 4-H programs, you know, they have a contract that the kids sign as well.
Right.
Yeah, I think that would be my advice, is absolutely try to work with sanctuaries in the area, because, of course, if you do get the animal released, you're going to need a safe place for him or her to live the rest of their lives. And then also, you know, as early as possible to decide you want to pull that animal from the program, I think the more hope there would be for having an amenable outcome to that.
That was Danielle Hanash, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. They're a 4-H alternative for students who want the experiences and education that 4-H offers in the agriculture sphere without the killing. As always, you can read more about this program and the case of Cedar, the 4-H goat, by following the links at the Voices for the Animals episode page at kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals. You'll also find a podcast of this episode there as well, and we invite you to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And that'll do it for this episode of Voices for the Animals. I'm Michelle Coppola, and until next month, be kind to animals, to others, and most of all to yourself.
This is KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means that we are funded by you, the listener. This morning, we are once again joined by Ben Garbolano in what is traditionally called Bond November. And this time, our Bond expert will focus on the Bondmobiles.
It's James Bond in a deadly game of four land and sea battles based on the thrilling Bond movie classics. Survive, and you become the master spy, 007. And Gyrus.
Here we are once again on Film 11, and we've got Ben Garbolano once again to talk a little bit more about James Bond movies, but specifically some of the toys and gadgets that he had. You know, one of the interesting facets of the series of movies is how they came up with things from the real world, like particular cars, and then they invented certain things or added things to those cars. The primary car from the beginning was the Aston Martin.
Where's my Bentley?
Oh, he's had its day, I'm afraid.
But it's never let me down.
M's orders, 007. You'll be using this Aston Martin DB5 with modifications. Now, pay attention, please. Windscreen bulletproof as are the side and the rear windows. Revolving number plates, naturally. Valid all countries. Here's a nice little transmitting device called a Homer. You prime it by pressing that back like this. You see? The smaller model is now standard field issue, to be fitted into the heel of your shoe. Its larger brother is magnetic. Right. To be concealed in the car you're trailing while you keep out of sight. Reception on the dashboard here. Audio visual range 150 miles.
Ingenious and useful too. Allow a man to stop off for a quick one en route.
We've installed some rather interesting modifications. You see this arm here? Now open the top and inside are your defense mechanism controls. Smoke screen, oil slick, rear bulletproof screen, and left and right front wing machine guns. Now this one I'm particularly keen about. You see the gear lever here? Now if you take the top off, you'll find a little red button. Whatever you do, don't touch it.
Now, why not?
Because you'll release this section of the roof and engage and fire the passenger ejector seat.
Ejector seat? You're joking.
I never joke about my work, 007.
Okay, so yeah, the Aston Martin DB5. At the time, I mean, it was more aerodynamic than most things that America was making. America was like starting with like the Corvettes, kind of starting to get in that scene. But America was making a bunch of big, heavyweight, bulky cars with big straight line sixes and introducing small block V8s, and then eventually later in the late 60s getting into the big block V8s. But I believe it was almost kind of I've never really connected the dots this way before, but partially I think there's a connection with like what Carroll Shelby was doing with racing for a British racing team and racing, you know, one of these very similar small tight sports cars that the Americans had just never seen. They never kind of like built any cars that way. Everything, you know, since the 20s was just getting bigger and bigger and longer and more elegant lines and whatnot. But along comes kind of this new British era. And I think, you know, the DB5 was, you know, they always called back to the DB5, even to the latest James Bond movies. It was definitely a vital piece of franchise history. You know,
what does DB stand for in its name? Okay. Or does it matter?
That I don't know.
Oh, because a lot of times these cars have emblematic titles, but they don't really mean anything. They're done in any particular order, or if that makes any sense. You know, they're just random numbers or random letters. That always
in this helped. Okay, so I just looked it up in this case. So the DB5, the DB designation is from the initials of David Brown, who built up the company from 1947 onwards.
So Aston Martin had been around since the end of the Second World War. It'd been around a long time. So the British were really early in getting the sports car silhouette moving on the highways. But they're probably pretty expensive cars, I assume.
Oh, I mean, now they are well into the $1 million range.
Well,
a 1965 DB5 has got to be worth well over $1.5 million.
You know, like, talk about
probably in poor condition.
Talk about governmental overspending. You know, they just give him, in Goldfinger, for example, they just give him an Aston Martin to drive around, although they've outfitted it with various gadgetry, bulletproof shield, and an oil slick that can come out the back and befoul the undercarriage of a pursuing automobile and certain other things.
They had the headlight machine gun.
Oh yes,
which is awesome. And then, you know, like my personal favorite was the ejector seat for the passenger for any unwanted guests.
And what's funny is that they give it to him, they ship it over to I think it's Switzerland or someplace in Europe, and when he finally tracks down the factory, he uses all of those things in about 5 minutes, and then the car is wrecked.
It's he has all these crazy gadgets, you know, for what was it, 1965? It's Goldfinger.
64.
Excuse me.
Oh, so, yeah, no. I think it's 63. But
I think it was 62, 63, 64, wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Good.
We'll edit that out. But anyways, so he has all of these awesome gadgets, uses them all in probably less than 5 minutes of the film. And then is fooled by a mirror and crashes into a brick wall, going down a dead end alley.
That's crazy. That was about $1 million worth of car that he just in today's.
Well, yeah, today's money, yeah, for sure. I mean, back then it was probably like a $7,500 car. I'd have to look up like what it was, you know. But $7,500 in 1964, 1965.
I'm looking at a list of some of the cars, and there's from the very first movie, Dr. No, there is a big big reliance on cars that various people drive. A lot of Chevrolets and a LaSalle and a couple of Fords, but also a Vauxhall PA Velox, which I don't know what that is, but it sounds like it's a pretty expensive and exotic car. Do they do a lot of research? They must have done a lot of research to try to put the car with the appropriate person, be they a villain. For example, in Goldfinger, the villain has a golden Rolls Royce.
Yeah, I know for sure, at least like the radiator, the big old massive radiator on the front of it is looks like it's all completely gold, which I think they do spend, you know, a bit with, you know, different trying to pair up the cars to the characters.
Yeah, so the Americans in, when he's in Kentucky, it's just Fords and Chevys that the American people are driving around. Goldfinger himself has this bizarre Rolls Royce, and his minions are Oddjob.
Oddjob with the hat.
With the hat. He,
I'm not sure if we could consider the hat a gadget, but a lot of people do.
I know. But Felix Leiter, the American guy, drives a Ford Thunderbird. Yep. And Goldfinger also has a Lincoln Continental and a Ford Ranchero. So, Oddjob drives the Ford Ranchero, and that's when they're squashing the car.
Yeah, that's actually like one of my dad's like funniest stories that he ever told me, was that, you know, like that Ford Ranchero weighs like 5,000 or 6,000 pounds, and they just crush it into like a 3x3 or a 4x4 cubic block, and, you know, just drop it in the back of like an F-150 at the time, or I forget what kind of truck it actually is, but it's like it didn't have the payload to be able to drive off with a $6,000 car just sitting in the back of a flatbed.
Well, once the gold has been separated from the big cube, it probably weighs a little bit less.
Just a little bit. I forget what that was, $1 million in gold bullion, I think, is what the payout was for each one of those henchmen.
There's not just regular cars, but sometimes there's really odd cars. I can't remember which movie it is, but I know it takes place, I think it's a Pierce Brosnan Bond movie, in which that takes place somewhere in the Alps or in the snow, and he drives a car that's made out of ice. Am I misremembering that?
It's not made out of ice. It has like retro reflective abilities, so it's an invisible car.
Oh, that's it. Okay. But the hotel he's staying in is made out of ice, if I remember.
The hotel, yes, the hotel is made out of ice. That's correct.
How impractical would that be? One of the other fantastic features of the James Bond series is the set decoration. These immense lairs where the villains live and have their headquarters. But then here they have, which always seems like a really odd use of space. How come they don't give up when it's really obvious that they've lost the fight? Why do the minions just keep shooting and fighting? What do they get out of it? I don't get it.
I think it's that, you know, just like thinking outside of the box, because they've signed up to go with whatever crazy ego or you know, like crazy mastermind, you know, guy that wants to take over the entire world, you know, there's no coming back, you know, like it's you're all in as a henchman once you're, you know, like Oddjob working for Goldfinger, or what's the little guy, Knickknack, working for Scaramanga, you know, he's not, you know, you can't like put that on your resume and be like, well, I got the man with the golden gun killed. You so know, who's hiring?
So they're true believers.
True believers.
The invisible car, how long does that last in the movie before he gets destroyed by a ridiculous car chase?
I'm trying to remember if that one actually gets destroyed or not. I mean, that one also had a ejector seat that was a callback to the DB5 because he ends up like, I forget what it is. He's getting chased by like part of the villain's force and ends up like flipping the car upside down on ice, and it's skidding around. And then they're like, they're shooting a missile at him, and he hits the ejector seat to flip the car over. And because he flips the car over, the missile goes straight past and hits like the other guy that was chasing him.
Ah, yes, of course.
There wasn't too many crazy features on that one, but you know, I remember it had the good old retractable spikes in the tires approach for like winter, but they were like, you know, very excessive, you know, like he like drives up almost near like a 45 degree ice wall at one point, you know.
Do you have a favorite car or automobile or vehicle from the whole series?
It's kind of hard. I mean, like in Tomorrow Never Dies. Uh-huh. Like I feel like it was kind of like a really cool time, because he gets like this Ericsson phone in the very beginning. You know, Q is posing as like a Hertz rental agency guy, and he's checking out Bond with a BMW. I think it's a 750i or 750i. Yeah, 750i. And you know, he's telling him about all the functions, and he's asking him if he needs extra insurance and, you know, all this stuff. But he has a cell phone that controls the car. And I mean, at that time, early, I'd have to look up when that was, like 2000 or something like that. It was absolutely crazy. Right. And so, you know, like he gets the car, he goes and does something, and he comes back to find all these guys trying to get into his car. Uh-huh. And it's got, you know, like it's got like electroshock on it. And then, it's got like gas, like sleeping gas or something that comes out of it. It's got like missiles in the sunroof. But, you know, so a couple of guys get shocked, they gas, he starts it up, drives it around with his phone, then like jumps in it. Sitting in the back seat the whole time, and just driving it in the back seat, you know, on his cell phone, shooting rockets at people. And then, you know, eventually like gets out of the car. The car drives up to the top of a parking garage and jumps out and crashes directly into the, like the Hertz dealership front end window. And like, so that was really iconic for me growing up. I think one of the ones that really also like really stood out was the Lotus in The Spy Who Loved Me. When he just drives straight off the dock, and the female Russian spy like it's like pretending to look worried, you know, and then, you know, the car transforms into a submarine.
And
that I think also had like a whole like oil ink spot to like, you know, like make it so people couldn't see where they were going and whatnot. But like the funny thing with the female Russian is she's like, at one point, like they're trying to evade people underwater, and she starts flipping switches. And he's like, "How'd you know to do that?" She's like, "Oh, I stole the plans for this like 6 years ago."
The Bond movies, in that regard, have predicted the future. Elon Musk, like a Stanley Kubrick type of movie, they're anticipating the future from time to time, because the people who are working on these movies are always thinking of the future. They're trying to get the most advanced machinery and technology into the film in order to please the fans.
What's your favorite car, Doug?
Oh, I'm still fond of that. I remember it as being silver, but I don't think the Goldfinger car that he
Aston Martin DB5
uses to death in about a minute and a half of screen time. But I remember it as being gray. Were all the Aston Martins color coded? I mean, were they all gray, like the way a Ferrari is always red? Although I guess you could buy one if you're going to pay.
I think it was just the James Bond thing, where it's just like they just use like that gray silver for a lot of cars.
Oh, okay. Maybe they're more photogenic or something, or less shiny. Like you don't have any problem with their shininess interfering with the imagery
effect. Yeah, it could be a photography thing. I mean, it's also kind of like, if it's not a bright silver, if it's just kind of like that gray kind of gunmetal-ish color, like you don't stand out, you know, in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where like the 60s was, you know, kind of like the resurgence of color and going into the 70s, you know, like going into the 70s of like the very generic, like toned down yellows and reds and greens, where they were like they were more vibrant in the 60s, but I feel like in the 70s going into the 80s it became kind of monotone almost. You know, like you don't stand out as well in a silver car, as opposed to like, I think in Goldfinger it's like what the female counterpart is like driving like a yellow convertible Thunderbird or something like that. You know, it's like the fact that she's like, it was a Mustang. Excuse me, it was a Mustang. You know, like she's racing around, you know, passing James Bond, you know, trying to get ahead to get a shot on Goldfinger.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, that's a pretty obvious car that stands out like a sore thumb, you know.
Well, what is the symbiotic relationship between the rise of the sports car in America and the James Bond movies? Because you mentioned that England was starting to or get it, move into the sports car market in a big way.
Yeah. I think there's a few different ways to look at that. Like, yeah, you know, like England was basically like knocking out Ferrari at the, for me, that's the ultimate pleasure of driving is having that ultimate control. Whereas, you know, the only time it sucks is when you're in stop and go traffic.
Yeah.
You know, that is the only time I'm in my manual car and I'm like, you know, an automatic would be real nice, you know, when I'm crawling for the next 20 minutes, you know.
And then also when you're taking a lot of vast curves in a mountainous area, you know, you can downshift and upshift, and really car is just this an external part of your body. And then especially with the sports cars, is there an optimum distance from the ground to the body of the car itself? I mean, can a car be too low to the ground, or perhaps even worse, too high up off of the ground?
Yeah, you can definitely be too high off the ground. Too low is probably going to depend on exactly, you know, the way the body is molded and what the airflow looks like, because you do want to have airflow both under and over the car. But, you know, the more airflow over the car will impact downforce, and in some, you know, in cases where like you have a big heavy front engine car, the rear end is going to be much lighter, and so being able to grab some of the downforce at the back of the car where the power is actually going to those wheels gives it more pressure, more traction in order to accelerate out of a corner, for instance.
We've been talking to Ben Garbellano, and he's not just the James Bond expert, but clearly an expert on automotives. And gosh, who knows what else you're a fan, an expert on that we can explore in the future. But yeah, so this is a part two of our little James Bond series in celebration of the November, additional month of November is the month of the James Bond.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I think it one of the Ted Turner stations, TBS, they always called it the Bond station.
The Bond station, yeah, that's fantastic.
And I think it kind of went all the way through the holidays. I felt like it kind of lingered.
Yeah.
You know, like it was one of the only cable stations that you could watch that didn't fall into the Thanksgiving theme or the Christmas theme, and you know, and sort of all of that kind of lingered in. It was like, no, we're going to have action for guys, so there's actually something entertaining to watch besides when there's not football on.
And you're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. Thanks again, Ben. And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about